Good morning. It's Tuesday, the 22nd of April, 2025, and you're listening to the Wall Street Journal here on Sun Sounds of Arizona with your volunteer reader, Chuck Kaufman, here in Flagstaff. Today, we have these headlines from the front page of the Wall Street Journal. Pope of Firsts reshaped church. Stocks dollar nosedive as Trump flogs Fed. And who are frontrunners for the papacy? Starting with our first article from the Vatican by Francis X. Rocha, Pope of Firsts reshaped church. Francis, who died at 88, promoted social justice, faced fallout over sex abuse cases. Pope Francis, who sought to refocus the Catholic Church on promoting social and economic justice rather than traditional moral teachings, but presided over growing divisions in the Church and struggled with the lingering scandal of clerical sex abuse, has died, the Vatican said. He was 88. The Pope's death from a stroke and heart failure on Easter Monday came after he spent weeks in the hospital this year to treat a serious bout of pneumonia. His health remained fragile after he returned to his Vatican residence. Jorge Mario Bergoglio was a Pope of Firsts. He was the first Pope from the Americas, the first from the Jesuit order, and the first to take the name Francis. He was the first in almost six centuries to become Pope after his predecessor resigned. Francis also gave the papacy a less formal and more approachable image by spurning regal attire, riding in compact cars and making headlines with blunt comments. He was openly political, urging grassroots activists to bridge the gap between rich and poor while calling on wealthier countries to better protect the environment. As Western politicians moved to close their borders to refugees, Francis advocated for them and other migrants. In February, he criticized President Trump's plan to carry out mass deportations. He maintained a neutral stance on the war in Ukraine, deploring the suffering of Ukrainians but avoiding direct condemnation of Russia and suggesting the West had provoked the conflict. Francis's policy of playing down traditional church teachings on marriage and homosexuality, his most famous single remark, was a rhetorical question about gay priests. Who am I to judge? Cheered liberals while distressing conservative Catholics, including many bishops in the U.S., but he stopped short of relaxing rules on celibacy for Roman Catholic priests, disappointing progressive bishops who argued that it would remedy shortages of clergy. Francis endorsed zero tolerance for priests who sexually abused children, but victims and their supporters said he didn't do enough to tackle the problem. In the biggest scandal of his pontificate, a former Vatican diplomat publicly accused him of turning a blind eye to sexual misconduct by a U.S. cardinal and called on him to resign. Francis's decisions over whom to appoint as cardinals, the men who will elect his successor, were notably strategic. He passed over prominent conservative bishops installed by his predecessor, Pope Benedict XVI, in dioceses such as Los Angeles and Venice, and appointed others from places such as Tonga and Laos, far from the Church's major population centers. By the time of his death, the Pope had named about two-thirds of the cardinal electors. A two-thirds majority of electors is required to select the next Pope. Whether the next Pope pursues or diverges from Francis's agenda, the tensions and polarization that grew under his stewardship are likely to persist. Quick rise. He was born on December 17, 1936, in Buenos Aires, the first of five children of an Italian immigrant father and an Argentine woman of Italian origin. He studied at a vocational high school with a focus on chemistry and worked occasionally as a doorman in local bars, where he was known as a proficient tango dancer. Just shy of his 16th birthday, he felt an urge to enter a church and confess his sins. When he later decided to become a priest, his mother objected, telling him she hoped he would pursue a medical career. He told her he would be studying the medicine of the soul. After joining the Jesuits, an order that emphasized social justice, the future Pope volunteered for missionary work in Japan, but was turned down, he later said, because he'd lost part of his right lung to pneumonia at the age of 20. He was ordained a priest in 1969 and 4 years later was named the leader of Argentina's Jesuits at the extraordinarily young age of 36. Bergoglio was still serving in that role when a military dictatorship took over Argentina in 1976. His record in that period would weigh on him for years. Some accused him of having collaborated with the junta's dirty war against its political opponents, including two Jesuits who were kidnapped and tortured for several months. Nobel Peace Laureate Adolfo Perez Esquivel, a former political prisoner of the dictatorship, later exonerated Francis of complicity with the regime and credited him with quiet diplomacy on behalf of its victims. The Pope acknowledged criticisms of his record after making enemies within the Jesuit order. He was transferred to the city of Cordoba, a more than 400 miles from the capital, Buenos Aires, where he spent 2 years. He later described this as a time of great interior crisis. His exile ended in 1992 when his friend, Cardinal Antonio Corazino, persuaded Pope John Paul II to appoint him as one of Buenos Aires' auxiliary bishops. When the cardinal died in early 1998, Bergoglio succeeded him and he became a cardinal in 2001. Bergoglio became known for living a modest life and ministering to Buenos Aires' sprawling shanty towns. He spurned the archbishop's palace in favor of a simple apartment. When John Paul died in 2005, Bergoglio emerged as the leading liberal candidate to succeed him. John Paul had reversed much of the progressive momentum that followed the Second Vatican Council, which aimed to rebalance the Church's relationship and the modern world during the 1960s, but the conclave elected Benedict, who continued the conservative line. Then in February 2013, Benedict shocked the Church by resigning, pleading the debility of old age. Bergoglio, by then 76 years old, wasn't on many short lists of possible successors, yet a small group of liberal cardinals quietly lobbied for his candidacy. The cardinal also impressed his peers shortly before the vote with a speech that said the church must become less focused on itself and direct its energy toward evangelizing the wider world. Many observers took that as an implicit retort to Benedict's prediction that the church in the West was shrinking to a faithful core. On just the fifth ballot on March 13th, the cardinals chose Bergoglio as the 265th successor to St. Peter. When he emerged on the balcony of St. Peter's Basilica, he stood without the formal cape other popes had worn and greeted the crowds below with a simple good evening before asking them to bless him, a different sort. It became clear that Francis would be a different sort of pontiff. He rode in a Ford Focus and stayed in a two-room suite in the Vatican guesthouse rather than move into the Apostolic Palace. He set up bodies to overhaul the Vatican's finances and bureaucracy and make it a poor church for the poor. That reflected his choice of papal name after St. Francis of Assisi, a medieval church reformer who abandoned a life of wealth for extreme poverty. He continued efforts begun under Benedict to prevent money laundering at the scandal-plagued Vatican Bank. He centralized the Vatican's investments and put them under the oversight of a panel of outside experts. The Pope criticized global capitalization and often called attention to the plight of migrants. In his 2015 ecological encyclical, Laudato Si, the Pope called on political leaders to reduce carbon emissions to combat climate change. Francis also made a priority of improving ties with the Islamic world, insisting that Islam was, like Christianity, a nation of peace. He also tried to improve the Vatican's relations with China. If Francis had a byword for his papacy, it was mercy. He often spoke of putting forgiveness ahead of censure and judgment and loosened the traditional ban on communion for divorced Catholics who remarry without their first marriages being annulled. He met with a gay couple and transgender man, suggested Catholics follow their consciences in using contraception to prevent disease, supported civil unions for same-sex couples, and called for an end to anti-homosexuality laws. Conservatives, including some cardinals and bishops, complained that the Pope was blurring the lines on doctrine and even trying to change it. During his watch, bishops in Germany acted as the Church's progressive vanguard, holding meetings where they called for changes, including women's ordination, blessings for same-sex relationships, a greater role for lay people in church governance, and relaxation of the celibacy requirement for priests. While Francis expressed some unease with the Germans' initiative and warned them not to stray too far from the rest of the church, he also called a global synod, which culminated in meetings at the Vatican in fall 2024. The conclusions disappointed progressives who were hoping for dramatic changes, angered victims. However, no controversy during his reign rivaled the impact of the scandals over the sexual abuse of children by priests. Francis hardly mentioned the topic in the first year of his papacy. When he did set up an advisory body on child protection that included former victims of abuse, he didn't act on any of its principal recommendations, including creating a special tribunal to judge bishops who abused or covered up abuse. Bishops in the U.S. and a handful of other countries urged him to adopt their practice of permanently barring abusers from serving as priests. Instead, he established a board that reduced the sentences of a large minority of abusers to periods as short as 3 years, reversing the policy of the previous pope. Francis angered sex abuse victims again in 2018 by repeatedly saying a Chilean bishop accused of covering up abuse was a victim of slander. He later said he had been misinformed and accepted the resignations of several Chilean bishops implicated in abuse scandals. Later the same year, a former Vatican envoy to the U.S. accused the Pope of ignoring allegations of sexual misconduct against then-Cardinal Theodore McCarrick, a former Archbishop of Washington, D.C., and making him an advisor. Francis waited until the following spring to deny the accusations, by which time a Vatican court had found McCarrick, who denied wrongdoing until his death this month, guilty of sexual abuse of minors and sexual misconduct with adults. He was the first cardinal in modern times to be removed from the priesthood. During 2019, Francis responded to criticism with a number of high-profile initiatives against sexual abuse. However, advocates for abuse victims criticized the process for investigating and disciplining bishops as lacking in transparency. But Francis's biggest legacy for the church could be his focus on social and economic issues, especially in the global South. Whether that continues will depend on how the coming papal conclave votes. If so, it would be a fitting legacy for a pope who described himself as coming from the ends of the earth. And that's Pope of First's reshaped church. Vicky Gi Huang writes our next article, Stocks Dollar Nosedive as Trump Flogs Fed. Dow Index falls 972 as president's swipes at Powell exacerbate investors' tariff fears. The stock market plunged and the dollar hit fresh lows against major currencies on Monday after President Trump renewed his attacks on the Federal Reserve and intensified the Sell America trade. The president's renewed threats to fire Fed Chair Jerome Powell, whose term doesn't expire for another year, exacerbated turmoil wrought by the administration's trade restrictions. Trump demanded on Monday lower interest rates in a post on social media saying that the economy could slow unless Mr. Too Late, a major loser, lowers interest rates now. Trump himself nominated Powell as Fed's chair during the first term. The Dow Jones Industrial Average dropped nearly 972 points Monday and is on pace for its worst April since 1932. The dollar hit fresh multi-year lows against the euro and other major currencies. Yields on longer-term treasuries, which rise when bond prices fall, climbed. Oil prices slid. Gold hit a record. After the markets closed in the U.S., stock futures rose while Asian stocks were slightly lower. Threats to Powell's job marked a new source of uncertainty for investors who said eroding confidence in the independence of the U.S. Central Bank could deal a significant blow to the value of stocks, bonds, and the dollar. The index performance on Monday. While Trump made similar threats against the Fed in his prior term, investors now worry that Trump's tariffs could rekindle pandemic-era inflation, requiring the central bank to keep rates higher, not lower. Some worry that recent declines in stocks, bonds, and the dollar, which has become known as the Sell America trade, point to a shift in capital flows that undermines the U.S.'s long-standing primacy in global markets. It is concerning, said Carol Schlieff, chief market strategist at BMO Private Wealth, of the broad-based declines. The bigger issue people are trying to assess, is the bloom truly off the U.S. exceptionalism trade just in the short term, or is it going to be an intermediate or longer-term factor? The Dow Industrials fell by 2.5%. The S&P 500 lost 2.4%, and the NASDAQ Composite shed about 2.6%. Investors sold tech stocks and shares of companies that make goods, like electronics or clothing, that consumers tend to cut back on when times get rough. Particularly hard hit were the so-called Magnificent Seven tech companies that had helped power major indexes higher in recent years. NVIDIA lost 4.5% and was among the biggest decliners in the blue chip index. Amazon.com fell 3.1%. The past few months have been particularly punishing for Tesla, which fell around 5.8% Monday. Its shares have now erased all of their post-election gains and have plummeted 44% in 2025 so far. On Monday, Tesla dropped outside of the largest 10 U.S. companies by market value for the first time since June 2024. The electric vehicle maker is grappling with slower sales and a damaged brand, with chief executive Elon Musk's prominent role in the Trump administration alienating some customers. The company is set to report earnings Tuesday. Analysts are expecting a year-over-year drop in profit, FactSet estimates show. Stocks and other riskier assets had shown some signs of stability last week after Trump announced a 90-day pause on many tariffs. Still, investors remain nervous about the lack of developments in trade negotiations, with some saying calming investors will require substantial progress in a short time. An early set of data from trade bellwether South Korea showed a big drop in exports to the U.S. this month. Supposedly, there's been lots of negotiations happening, but there haven't been any deals announced, said R.J. Grant, head of global equity trading at Stifel and KBW. The longer that drags on, the more there's going to be some angst and anxiety in the markets. The prospect of Powell's removal by Trump, who wants the Fed to lower rates, extended a recent climb in longer-term Treasury yields. Yields, which rise when bond prices fall, have already been lifted in recent weeks by worries that tariffs will fuel inflation and weaken foreign demand for U.S. debt. On Friday, when markets were closed, National Economic Council Director Kevin Hassett underscored the White House's displeasure with Powell, saying officials were studying his removal. The dollar hit fresh multi-year lows against most major currencies, including the euro, yen, and pound. The Wall Street Journal Dollar Index, which measures the dollar against a basket of currencies, fell 0.7% Monday to its lowest level since September. It's really hard to get conviction in risk assets when it's really beholden to one person that's making the decision, said John Lloyd, head of multi-sector credit strategies at Janus Henderson. Investors searching for safety in the market turmoil piled into gold. The precious metal touched a fresh record, settling above $3,400 a troy ounce for the first time. And some traders are wagering on the surge to continue, rushing into option bets that would likely pay out if gold prices kept rising. Trading in call options tied to one of the largest gold exchange traded funds, trades that give it the right to buy shares at a given price by a stated date, surged to an all-time high last week. There were a handful of winners in the stock market, too. Dollar General added 2.7%, Netflix rose 1.5% after the streaming giant last Thursday posted a better-than-expected earnings report. Shares of Capital One Financial rose 1.5% after the credit card issuer's $35 billion acquisition of Discover Financial Services got the green light from bank regulators on Friday. Discover gained 3.6%. That stock's dollar nosedive as Trump flogs Fed. Our next article, who are the front runners for the papacy? This is by Marcus Walker from Rome. The last time the Catholic Church's cardinals picked a pope, they wanted an outsider to overhaul a scandal-plagued Vatican. They got more of a disruptor in Pope Francis than many had bargained for. After Francis's stormy 12-year pontificate, some cardinals now say they want a successor who can steady the ship and defuse tensions between progressives and conservatives over divorce, same-sex relationships, priestly celibacy, and other contentious issues. Many cardinals are tired of the roller coaster that's been this pontificate. Many of them will look for some stability, said Massimo Fagioli, a church historian at Villanova University. Francis appointed 108 of the 135 cardinals who can vote, so it's unlikely a majority will repudiate his efforts to bring the church closer to ordinary believers, especially the poor and marginalized, by emphasizing its pastoral role over a doctrinaire finger-wagging. Only a small number of traditionalist cardinals want to return to a papacy that enforces a universal orthodoxy on sexual morality and gender issues, in the manner of Francis's predecessor, Benedict XVI, but a larger minority of moderate conservatives could block contenders they view as too radical on questions such as women's ordination, priestly celibacy, and blessings for same-sex couples. An ideologically moderate cardinal with a diplomatic finesse to bridge the church's divisions while maintaining Francis's outreach to the world beyond the Catholic Church, including developing relations with other faiths and maintaining a voice on political and economic issues. Yet the ideal candidate needs technocratic skills to fix the Vatican's chronic and growing budget deficit, an area where Francis struggled. And he probably shouldn't be too young, remaining much less than 70 years of age. Cardinals are usually wary of picking a young pope whose reign might be overly long. None of the men seen as papabile, Italian for popeable, tick every box. That makes this conclave one of the most open contests in recent history. Here are 10 of the men seen as front runners. Some experts said the list is potentially twice as long and a wild card pick is possible. Cardinal Pietro Parolin. The 70-year-old Italian is the Vatican Secretary of State, effectively its Prime Minister. Undoubtedly a contender, he has the global contacts and diplomatic skills to assemble supporters in the College of Cardinals. Parolin would represent continuity, but he didn't have the closest relationship with Francis, which could help him with skeptics of the last pope. His lack of charisma could count against him. Cardinal Mario Grech. The Maltese Cardinal, 68, is a leading progressive candidate. He is a champion of Francis's lenient stance on giving communion to Catholics who divorce and remarry, and he's defended liberal German bishops who push to change church practices, including allowing ordination of women deacons. He advocates a decentralized institution that allows for different ways to engage followers in a diverse, globalized church, but conservatives have warned of a schism in the church unless progressives push for changes is reined in. Cardinal Péter Erdő, the 72-year-old primate of Hungary, is perhaps the strongest conservative contender. A multilingual intellectual, Erdő has called for unity within the church. His views on divorce, immigration, gay civil unions, or the use of the Latin Mass are traditional, but he isn't as hardline as some of Francis's toughest critics. Skeptics have said he lacks charisma and a popular touch. Cardinal Luis Antonio Tagle. the Asian Francis, former Archbishop of Manila and now a senior official in the Vatican administration, is a leading contender from the Global South. The 16-year-old Filipino cardinal shares Francis's focus on social justice and preference for a merciful church while defending traditional Catholic teachings on abortion and contraception. His star has dimmed since 2022 when Francis removed him as the head of Caritas Internationalis, the church's global charitable organization following management and morale problems. Tagle might also be too young for cardinals who don't want a long pontificate. Cardinal Fridolin Ambongo Bisungo. After the Argentine Francis, choosing the Archbishop of Kinshasa would be another leap toward a more global papacy. Africa is the continent where Catholicism is growing most. The Congolese cardinal would uphold Francis's focus on social justice, the poor, and dialogue with other faiths. Ambongo has objected to Francis's lenient guidelines on priestly blessings for same-sex couples, which could appeal to conservatives. His relative youth at 65 could hurt him. Cardinal Robert Francis Prevost. An American pope is hard to imagine, most Vatican watchers said. Many cardinals don't want to look like they're aligning the global church with the superpower. If any contender can overcome having a U.S. passport, it might be the Chicago-born Cardinal Prevost. Prevost rose under Francis to become the Vatican's top official for selecting bishops in much of the world. At 69, he would be a dark horse. Cardinal Gerald Lacroix. A North American pope would more likely be Canadian than American. The Archbishop of Quebec supported Francis's humility and emphasis on a pastoral listening church. Francis made him a member of his Council of Cardinals, a body the Pope established to advise on church governance. Last year, Lacroix was cleared of sexual abuse allegations. At 67, he's among the younger contenders. Cardinal Charles Mong Bo. Myanmar's first cardinal is perhaps the strongest contender from Asia. He's about the right age at 76 and could bridge some of the differences between progressives and conservatives. He was close to Francis, but also expressed admiration for Francis's conservative predecessor, Benedict. Bo supported Francis's vision of a church that listens and his concern for the environment. Cardinal Matteo Zuppi, the Archbishop of Bologna, is another progressive favorite who could continue Francis's work, seeking to make the church more inclusive while reaching out to other faiths. The 69-year-old is close to the Catholic lay community, Sant'Egidio, an international association involved in social work. Zuppi's left-wing image could count against him. Cardinal Jean-Marie Avellan. The Archbishop of Marseille is seen as a protege of Francis with a popular touch. He champions a church welcoming to marginalized people and dialogue with other religions. He hasn't been outspoken on polarizing topic, and he is on the young side at 66. That article, Who Are the Front Runners for the Papacy? You're listening to the Wall Street Journal here on Sun Sounds of Arizona with your volunteer reader, Chuck Kaufman. Remember, you can listen to the Wall Street Journal and other Sun Sounds of Arizona programming at a time of your choosing or as it streams on the Sun Sounds of Arizona website at sunsounds.org, on the Sun Sounds of Arizona app available at the Apple App Store for your iPad or iPhone, or the Google Play Store for your Android phone or tablet, or you can listen to the Sun Sounds of Arizona stream on your Amazon Dot or Echo. Well, we'll turn now to the business and finance section of the Wall Street Journal for these headlines: Crypto knocks on banking's door, goods bound for U.S. stuck in tariff limbo, and oil patch confronts its huge wastewater problem. That first headline, Crypto Knocks on Banking's Door. Circle, BitGo, and others plan to apply for mainstream charters or licenses. This is by Gina Heeb and Vicky Guihang. crypto is pushing deeper into the banking system. A regulatory crackdown on crypto in the wake of a meltdown of FTX and two crypto-friendly banks prompted some in traditional finance to break up with the industry 2 years ago. Now, President Trump's pledge to make America a Bitcoin superpower has set the stage for crypto to become more intertwined with the banking system. Several crypto firms, including Circle and BitGo, plan to apply for bank charters or licenses, according to people familiar with the matter. Crypto exchange Coinbase Global and stablecoin company Paxos are considering similar moves, other people said. That comes as the Trump administration moves to incorporate crypto into mainstream finance and Congress advances a pair of bills that would establish a regulatory framework for stablecoins, which let people easily trade in and out of more volatile cryptocurrencies. The legislation would require stablecoin issuers to have charters or licenses from regulators. Some crypto firms are interested in national trust or industrial bank charters that would enable them to operate more like traditional lenders, such as by taking deposits and making loans. Others are after relatively narrow licenses that would allow them to issue a stablecoin. World Liberty Financial, the Trump family's crypto project, unveiled plans to launch a stablecoin called USD1 last month. It said the stablecoin's reserves would be safeguarded by crypto custodian BitGo, which is getting close to submitting the bank charter application, people familiar with the matter said. Any crypto firm that obtains a bank charter would become subject to stricter regulatory oversight. Anchorage Digital, so far the only crypto firm in the country with a federal bank charter, said it spends tens of millions of dollars to comply with regulations. In 2022, a bank regulator issued a consent order against Anchorage, pointing to anti-money laundering deficiencies. It has not been easy, said Nathan McCauley, chief executive officer of Anchorage, which obtained its charter in 2021. But he said the whole gamut of regulatory and compliance obligations that banks have can be intertwined with the crypto industry. The San Francisco-based company this year became a custodian for BlackRock's iShares Bitcoin Trust alongside Coinbase. Anchorage also joined with Cantor Fitzgerald, along with crypto custodian Copper, for the firm's $2 billion Bitcoin-backed lending program. Tether is a major client of Cantor, which was previously headed by Commerce Secretary Howard Lutnick. Stablecoins are pegged to the dollar or other government-issued currencies and store reserves in cash or cash-like assets such as treasuries to keep a one-to-one ratio in value in place. Tether is the largest stablecoin with a $145 billion market capitalization, and Circle's USD coin is the second largest with roughly $61 billion of tokens in circulation. Just a few years ago, major banks cut ties with the crypto firms after a regulatory crackdown on the industry following FTX's collapse. After the downfall of Silvergate Capital and Signature Bank, many founders in the industry struggled to find new banks that would take their deposits or lend to them. After Trump returned to the White House, regulators rolled back rules requiring banks to get approval to engage in crypto activities. Further guidance for how banks can engage with crypto is expected later this year, a person familiar with the matter said. Meanwhile, some banks are looking to play catch-up and forge ties with the industry. In February, Bank of America Chief Executive Brian Moynihan said his bank would issue its own stablecoin if a legal framework for doing so is established. U.S. Bancorp said this month would relaunch its crypto custody service through a partnership with NYDIG, a Bitcoin trading and banking firm. Separately, a consortium of banks, which includes Deutsche Bank and Standard Chartered, has started to examine how to expand crypto operations to the U.S., according to a person familiar with the matter. A spokesman for Deutsche Bank declined to comment. Standard Chartered didn't respond to a request for comment. And that's Crypto Knocks on Banking's Door. Jeannie Whalen and Bob Tita write our next article, Goods Bound for U.S. Stuck in Tariff Limbo. Just after the Trump administration raised tariffs on Chinese goods to 145% this month, a truck full of fake eyelashes came to a screeching halt in Mexico, just shy of the U.S. border. The lashes, made in China and shipped to a Mexican port, were on their way to U.S. customers of Lilac Street, a company founded by Seattle businesswoman Alicia Zeng. One of Zeng's employees had phoned the company's warehouse in Mexico and told them to send humans to flag down that truck because Lilac Street couldn't afford import tariffs higher than the value of the cargo itself, Zeng said. If we pay 145% tariffs, we'd lose a significant amount of money on every product we send in, she said. Many U.S. companies are making similar hard calls as they scramble to adjust to President Trump's new trade war with China. Some are halting imports as they hope for a trade truce that will result in lower tariffs. A few, interviewed by the Wall Street Journal, are trying to move their production from China to the U.S., but most are eyeing other Asian countries, saying U.S. production of their goods doesn't exist. Many are reluctant to make big changes if the new rules are just going to get overturned by a tweet. When they make a decision, they change their mind, and when they change their mind, they change it again, said Clifton Bromond, whose company, Man and Machine, assembles waterproof keyboards and mice in Maryland from Asian and domestic components. He's considering moving that assembly to Malaysia to escape some of the tariff burden, but the uncertainty makes it hard to plan. The goods these U.S. companies sell are often the kind of whimsical or niche products that have thrived in an area of e-commerce and low-cost Asian manufacturing. Golf practice nets, smartphone mounts that stick to a dashboard, and eyelash glue. Zeng started her company during the pandemic, figuring she would provide an alternative for women who couldn't go to the salon for lash extensions. She spent the summer of 2020 boxing up lashes on her living room couch. 5 years later, she has annual revenue of $15 million and 15 U.S. employees who work remotely in Michigan, Ohio, Texas, and other states. The company's success hinges on the delicate, feathery lashes churned out by a supplier in the fake eyelash capital of the world, Guangzhou, China. Factories there buy ultra-thin plastic fibers from South Korean suppliers, which they cut and curl into faux lashes. Then the really hard work begins. Workers use tweezers to lift single fibers and arrange them into small clusters resembling human lashes, Zeng said. It's so delicate, and you couldn't just turn on a machine somewhere and do this, she said. The production just does not exist in the United States for reasons you can imagine. She added, Lilac Street sells the lashes for $6 to $11 a package. Zeng for now is holding her truck at the Mexican warehouse, hoping for some resolution to the trade war. Several other shipments that are halfway across the ocean will soon join the truck. Zeng has 2 to 3 months of inventory in the U.S. that she can continue selling. I think we're trying to hold out for at least one more month to see what happens, but then we'll have to make some hard choices, she said. She's asked her Chinese suppliers about moving production elsewhere in Asia, but she said they aren't ready to commit. Basic Fun, a Boca Raton, Florida-based seller of children's toys, has also halted shipments from China, hoping that tariffs recede to more manageable levels. The company has about 2 months of inventory of Lincoln Logs, Care Bears, and other items in U.S. warehouses, Chief Executive Jay Foreman said. Basically, what we're doing is eating our inventory and hoping that it will last us until this gets settled, he said. If it doesn't, we'll be out of business. Toy manufacturing was one of the first industries that took root in China decades ago. Even if you wanted to make things here, the components all come from China, Foreman said. Some shipping companies are so concerned about U.S. importers abandoning their cargo and declining to pay shipping fees that they're asking for full payment up front. Hong Miller, owner of Wind City Trade, an import-export company in Grosse Pointe, Michigan, said her longtime shipping company usually requires only a deposit up front, but recently asked for full payment. Many entrepreneurs are scrambling to move production out of China. Bob Rammer's company in Traverse City, Michigan, sells aluminum handrails and other accessories that get installed in RVs. He started reshoring some of the production from China to Michigan a few years ago and moved other production lines to India. New tariffs are now prompting him to move the remainder of his China-based manufacturing. His company, Stromberg Carlson Products, found a Michigan aluminum supplier to sell him the raw materials to make one of his handrails. No small matter, as Trump's 25% tariff on imported aluminum has created a scramble for domestic sources. They said, "Bob, we'll support that. You're bringing it home from China. We'll support that," Brammer said. He just had a machinery supplier, Haas Automation, come by to estimate the cost of new manufacturing equipment, and he needs to have 8 molds made to produce hardware for the rails. Brammer said he supports the tariffs overall and is glad to bring more production back to the U.S., but he wishes the Trump administration had given companies more time to prepare. "I've got to get this stuff made soon to keep my inventory flowing smoothly. I've got to get it up and running in 8 weeks," he said. Trump's tariffs during his first administration prompted many U.S. companies to reduce their reliance on China. Roger Alvis, chief executive of Scotia Industries, a consumer electronics company in Oxnard, California, said the firm has reduced its production in China from 90% of its goods to 30% since 2018, shifting to other suppliers in Southeast Asia. The company has constantly tried to move the remaining production out, but it's been hard to find manufacturers elsewhere that can do the work as well at such a good price. Alvis said, "Bringing the work to the U.S. isn't realistic," he said, "because the U.S. doesn't produce many types of electronics." And that's goods bound for U.S. stuck in tariff limbo. Our next article is from Martin County, Texas, by Benoit Moraine. An oil patch confronts its huge wastewater problem. 2 dozen cone-shaped floating evaporators hum on a huge saltwater pond in the middle of the biggest oil field in the U.S. They're part of an experiment by ExxonMobil to address one of the challenges facing frackers in the Permian Basin of West Texas and New Mexico. What to do with the gargantuan amounts of noxious water they produce alongside crude? As oil production has jumped to records in recent years, so have water volumes. Permian producers on average pump about 4 barrels of water for each barrel of crude. They've long reinjected it underground, which has caused the ground to buckle, triggered earthquakes, made drilling more onerous. Last year, Permian drillers discarded roughly 5.5 billion barrels of water that way, according to water analytics firm B3 Insight, roughly equivalent to the amount of water that New York City consumes in about 8 months. Now, companies are investing millions of dollars testing technologies to evaporate water faster and strip it of salt so it can be reused outside the oil patch. They're crafting plans to release scrubbed water into rivers and hope to one day provide it to farmers and municipalities. "We need a Manhattan Project to deal with the produced water," said Kirk Edwards, an oil executive and former chairman of the Permian Basin Petroleum Association, referring to the U.S. effort to produce the first atomic bomb. The Trump administration has taken notice. The Environmental Protection Agency last month announced it would reconsider wastewater regulations for the oil and gas industry to help unleash American energy. Peggy Brown, the EPA's acting assistant administrator at the Office of Water, said the review would consider reusing produced water for purposes from cooling data centers to fire control, power generation, and ecological needs. Companies in recent years have made strides in treating the brine and recycling for their operations, but more water flows back to the surface than they can use. Meanwhile, the volumes of liquid they can pump into the ground have shrunk as companies have started to run out of underground space and regulators have imposed limits on disposal to prevent earthquakes. enter the evaporators. Exxon, the largest Permian producer, started testing the machines about a year ago as a pilot project. The devices, manufactured by Colorado-based RWI Enhanced Evaporation, blow air down on the pond of produced water to create droplets and ripples, which speeds up the evaporation process. One machine costs about $46,000 and consumes about as much electricity as a wet-dry vacuum cleaner. RWI estimates that between 20 and 50% more liquid gets vaporized that way compared with natural evaporation. Wind, heat, humidity, and sunlight all have a bearing on how much water is vaporized. The technology is no panacea. While an injection well typically guzzles between 10 and 25,000 barrels of water a day, an evaporator working in optimal conditions vaporizes about 32 barrels an hour, according to Robert Ballantyne, a senior vice president at RWI. Rich Dealey, who oversees ExxonMobil's Permian operation, said the pilot project is just one of several options the company is studying to address the water issue. It's also looking at piping water to the fringes of the Permian, where there's more underground space available, as well as desalinization. Frackers say removing salt from produced water means it could be used to water city parks, golf courses, and potentially non-food crops such as cotton. Texas has granted some permits to release treated water into the environment. New Mexico has allowed companies to run pilot tests, but has stopped short of letting them discharge treated water outside the oil fields. How do we get surface disposal is kind of the next big step, said Dealey. Exxon says it aims to have a commercial-sized desalinization facility operating in the Permian by the end of next year. Energy services firm Tetra Technology and driller EOG Resources last month announced they were commencing a pilot project in to desalinate produced water from the Permian. Although it costs about twice as much to desalinate produced water as it does to inject it down a well, the companies are hopeful they can bring the cost down. Everybody is getting to the point now where this can be done effectively and it can be done cost-effectively, said Robert Cram, an executive vice president at Texas Pacific Water Resources, a water-focused unit of landowner Texas Pacific Land. The firm has tested desalinization technology at a 20 barrels a day pilot project outside Midland. One common technique to remove salt is to run the liquid through membranes that hold back solids. But oil field water, which is much saltier than seawater, takes a toll on the material. Instead, Crane's company freezes the brew, which helps separate salt water from fresher water. Crane's goal is to bring the cost of purifying a barrel down to 75 cents, which is slightly more than what it costs to flush it down a well. Texas Pacific Water Resources has begun constructing a $25 million desalinization facility with an initial capacity of 10,000 barrels of produced water a day, and plans to build a Permian plant 10 times as big next year. The company plans to use some of the desalinated water for restoration projects on land owned by Texas Pacific Land. It also has applied for a state permit to discharge a portion into a salty tributary of the Pecos River, which runs through the Permian to the Rio Grande. Starting with up to 20,000 barrels a day this year, increasing to 100,000 barrels in later years. Texas Pacific Water Resources has tested for hundreds more contaminants in the desalinated water than what is required by regulators, said Adriana Lopez, the company's research and development manager. She said the firm passed multiple rounds of a lab test to determine whether the purified water will hurt living aquatic organisms. We don't want to put something on the ground or in a river that's essentially going to cause harm or get us in trouble, she said. That's Oil Patch confronts its huge wastewater problem. Our next article from Business and Finance, Nike finds robots struggle to make shoes. This is by John Emmont. President Trump is betting that the threat of stiff tariffs on low-cost countries in Asia and elsewhere will pressure American companies to bring manufacturing and jobs back to the U.S. But high U.S. labor costs mean companies would have to find ways to replace human workers with machines. For some industries, that has proved surprisingly difficult. Indeed, a years-long effort by Nike to shift part of its manufacturing from China, Indonesia, and Vietnam to North America illustrates how tough it is for U.S. brands to wean themselves off the flexible, low-cost contract manufacturers that use army of laborers to churn out an array of products for American consumers. Starting in 2015, Nike poured millions into an effort to partly automate what has always been a labor-intensive industry. At the time, rising labor costs in China and advances in manufacturing techniques such as 3D printing opened the possibility of finding a new way to make shoes that would rely on fewer workers. The shoe giant turned to Flex, an American manufacturer that helped Apple set up a complex factory in Texas to make Mac Pros. The goal? Make tens of millions of Nike sneakers at a new high-tech manufacturing site in Guadalajara, Mexico. By 2023, the plant would include thousands of workers, but far fewer than are needed in Asia to make the same number of sneakers. If successful, the project could be a model for production in the U.S., according to some involved in the effort. Nike's competitor sensed an opportunity to rethink a manufacturing model built around Asian factories, where armies of cheap, skilled laborers stitch fabrics and glue soles to shoes by hand. It feels less modern and more like a Ford Model T production line combined with a Middle Ages cobbler's bench, said Kevin Haley, then the executive vice president of innovation at clothing maker Under Armour. In 2015, he pledged to use automation to make shoes in Baltimore, a project he called Project Glory. Around the same time, Adidas launched speed factories in Atlanta and Ansbach, Germany, with high-tech machinery that quickly spit out shoes. They want to move out of China and Vietnam, they have to have technology to do that differently, said Mike Dennison, Flex's then president, in 2016. Nike's effort was the boldest. The company aimed for a large-scale automated production in under a decade, which it said would save on labor costs and allow it to deliver new models of shoes to Americans faster. Tom Fletcher, who oversaw the project for Flex, came into the effort feeling confident, having just built a Mac Pro factory for Apple in Austin, Texas. Flex pushed to rejigger production lines and use automation, trying to find as many ways as possible to minimize human interaction. That experience came in handy. Nike and Flex established new production lines that used machines commonly seen in electronics manufacturing, but rarely in shoemaking, such as a pick-and-place machine that's known for mounting components onto circuit boards. The machines were supposed to build the upper part of a shoe, knit fabric, add logos, and glue the sole. The effort quickly ran into trouble. The robots struggled to handle the soft, squishy, and stretchy parts that are integral to shoemaking. Shoe fabrics expand and contract depending on the temperature, and in shoemaking, no two soles are exactly alike. Human workers can adapt to such challenges, but it proved difficult for machines. You're trying to do something very precise, and then it gets a little colder or warmer, and the material changes on you, said Fletcher. We did not anticipate that. As a result, factory production never became as automated as envisioned. As shoe production increased, the factory personnel swelled to 5,000, about twice as many as originally planned and costing more than a similar workforce in Vietnam. Task after task proved challenging to automate, like the delicate work of gluing soles to the upper parts of the shoes. If you didn't lay it the right way, there'd be a noticeable twisting of the shoe, a misalignment that aesthetically means it would fail quality tests, said Fletcher. A central problem was a huge variety of shoes Nike produces. Unlike cars or iPhones, shoe models are changing all the time. But automating manufacturing means designing simple products that machines can undertake over and over again. Electronics manufacturing uses hard, standardized materials, allowing machines to replicate the same step millions of times. You have to make sacrifices from how to design to the complexity of the materials and models you work with, said Michael Newton, the former Nike executive who oversaw the project. That goes against what the consumer wants. They want incredible diversity of product. At one point, it took the Flex team 8 months to figure out how to automate a way to put the Nike swish on a shoe, only for Nike to move on to a new shoe line for which the method Flex developed no longer worked. Newton said it would have been easier to mass produce uncomplicated shoes, such as ones with a machine knit upper part and matched with simple molded bottoms. But Nike was unwilling to put limits on its designs and expected manufacturers to produce whatever new shoes their teams dreamed up. By 2017, Flex's investors were balking at rising costs at the company, with some questioning why an outfit that makes electronics was involved in shoe production. Flex and Nike wound up the project by early 2019. By then, Under Armour stopped mentioning to investors its Project Glory mission to make shoes in the U.S. That year, Adidas, which also faced challenges producing complex shoes with robots, said it would close production in Atlanta and Germany. It shipped its Speed Factory technology to suppliers in Asia. The three shoemakers stuck with their original offshore locations, Vietnam, China, and Indonesia, even after pandemic-era factory shutdowns showed the risk of having such a concentrated node of production. Adidas, Under Armour, and Nike declined to comment on their past reshoring efforts. Representatives for Nike and Under Armour said the companies are working out responses to tariffs. Now China, Vietnam, and Indonesia are in Trump's sights. This month, he placed tariffs of 46 and 32% on Vietnam and Indonesia, respectively, before lowering them to 10% and granting them a 90-day reprieve. The U.S. raised tariffs on imports from China to 145%. Commerce Secretary Howard Lutnick said the administration wants labor-intensive industries to return to the U.S. There will be an army of millions and millions of people screwing in little screws to make iPhones, he said in a recent interview with CBS. The threat of new tariffs is pushing some to ask whether Nike and others will ultimately have to reconsider efforts to automate manufacturing and bring shoe production back to the U.S. Newton and Fletcher think it still could be done, although it wouldn't be easy. You need to have some deep pockets and some patience, because it's not going to happen fast, said Fletcher. The previous experience was humbling, for sure. That's Nike Finds Robots Struggle to Make Shoes. You've been listening to the Wall Street Journal here on Sun Sounds of Arizona with your volunteer reader, Chuck Kaufman. Remember, Sun Sounds of Arizona is available on sunsounds.org, the Sun Sounds of Arizona app, and on your Amazon Echo or Dot.